It gives me great pleasure to introduce Marissa from Orchid.
Thank you, Craig. My name is Marissa, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank Al, the secretary of this meeting, for asking me to be his co-secretary, to find people to speak at this meeting, only because it has really brought me to this meeting every week consistently. It has exposed me to many different stories, has caused me to be out of self. I'm really grateful to him. I never thought I would have a commitment like that. It's not even a real secretary, it's like a co. And yet, you know, it has really changed my life. Thank you to Craig for standing in as secretary tonight. And to all who make this meeting possible, I appreciate it. The club itself, it's really great to have a place to go when I'm feeling squirrely. And I want to thank Glenn for asking me to speak the very first time, because I don't have to have those jitters ever again. So I'm really grateful. This is my first time speaking. Also welcome to Chris and Jose. I remember when I was a newcomer, I hated raising my hand. I hated it so much I didn't go to meetings, so I didn't raise my hand, but I will get to that. So my hats are off to you that you are here, because it takes a lot of courage to raise your hand and identify as a newcomer. And to make that choice to not drink anymore, it was the hardest decision that I ever had to make. And so the fact that you're in this room today, here, making that decision is phenomenal. So I grew up in a pretty happy home. It was a beautiful neighborhood. My parents are still married to this day. Really no reason, from childhood where drinking, was not, should be part of my story. My sister and I are really close to this day. We're 22 months apart. We shared a room my whole life. I was telling my husband today, I slept on a bunk bed until I was out of college, because when I was in college, I also slept on a bunk bed. So, that was my life. It was very, for lack of a better word, it was an easy childhood. It was one where I was full of love. And yet I always felt like a black sheep. My parents both came from a family of five, so we had a lot of cousins, a lot of aunts and uncles that were around, and I always felt the need to not be where I was, in a family party or, whatever. I always felt like I wanted to get out of it, and I would look around and think, man, these people, my cousins, they can just talk to each other, they can share stories about who they are. My aunts, would ask me questions about my life, and I would think, why do you want to know? Why do you want to know about my life or what's going on with me? And I always felt like they were not out to get me, but they had some sort of ulterior motive. They wanted to get some dirt on me so they could talk mess about me behind my back, so that Marissa's not doing something that she's supposed to do or not do or what have you. And alcohol was around in the family. My parents drank, never saw them really drink to excess. They would have a drink with, cocktails, dinner, something like that. And my dad always made a big deal of saying that, I'm not going to drink to excess in front of you guys, because his father was an alcoholic. My grandfather was an alcoholic, a self-identified alcoholic. He went to AA. I never met him. He died before I was born. He died of pneumonia, but my father always likes to share that he really died of alcoholism, because he caught pneumonia in a bar. He got a cancer diagnosis. His doctor told him, stay away from places that are dirty. He went straight to the bar, caught pneumonia at the bar, and died 2 weeks later. So, this disease manifests in many different ways. So I always knew that the word alcoholic, at least according to my dad and my nuclear family, meant a person who, throws their life away, who can never get sober. And I always heard the rhetoric that AA didn't work. And I heard that because AA, from my father's perspective, did not work for his grandfather, or for his dad, for my grandfather. So, there was a lot of hurt in that family around that alcoholic. In contrast, there was a person on my mom's side who was named Uncle Charlie. And Uncle Charlie was fun. He he would play cards with the kids, you know, he had great stories, he was always laughing, he was smiley, he had a wife that they've been married for 25 years, he had three beautiful daughters that all had kids of their own, and those are my cousins, and he was a great friend. And after family parties, I would hear, you know, driving home, oh, did you see how much Charlie drank? You know, what an alcoholic, you know. So that word, I would hear it again, not really knowing what that meant, but it was attributed to this fun-loving, happy-go-lucky guy, you know, who for everything that I saw, you know, as a young kid, he had a job, he had a beautiful home, he could host family parties, he had kids, he had a wife, he was fun. You know, all these things were the word alcoholic. So, you know, growing up, getting into high school, it was kind of these two extremes. Like, you're either, alcohol either makes you, like, super fun and awesome, or rule with an iron fist and ruin your family's life. You know, like, these are the two extremes that I saw. So, when I was in high school, I was very judgmental of people who drank. Because I always heard from my family growing up that alcohol was done in college. Like, don't do it when you're in high school. You know, it's meant for the college scene. You know, everything like in our family was about college, you know. So, and I was an athlete in high school, and I was a runner. So, you know, even like a tenth of a second was a big deal to me. So I didn't ever want to jeopardize that. So mind you, alcohol had never touched my lips yet at this point. It was just what I thought about alcohol and what I had seen it do to my family. So I didn't drink, you know, and those who partied and those who went, I was like, oh, look at those people throwing their lives away. You know, they don't want to, they're drinking and they don't care about college, they don't care about school, you know, and even some of the kids on the team would go and I would think, oh, they're messing up their running. And so co-captain, you know, me and the other guy would always talk about, like, if they would just get together, you know, then our relay team would be faster and things would be, you know, we were very controlling at that time. And, you know, and even though I had all these things, you know, I was, like, elected to prom court, and I was on the track team, and I was captain, and I was getting straight A's, and going to college, I still never felt quite present. You know, I just never felt quite part of whatever group I was in, you know. And in high school, I was really known as being, like, a chameleon, you know, like, oh, Marissa, yeah, she can go to any group, you know, and she can hang with whoever. And that was because I didn't know who I was. You know, I would just, I'll put on whatever mask you need me to put on, I'll put whatever face you need me to put on, just so I can hang out with you, you know, sure, I like Asian food, you know, fine, you know, or, yeah, I'm into home ec, you know, or whatever, you know, I could be, you know, in anything, really not ever being myself, you know. And so, at the end of the day, I would always feel exhausted, you know, because it was like I was performing all day long. So, I had my first drink at 18, and that is not the first drink that I think got me in here, to be honest. So my first drink at 18, I was on a plane to Europe with my family, and because you can drink legally, you know, at 18 over there, in the airplane, that was the rule also. Like, we're flying to foreign areas, so we drink. And I remember it was a gin and tonic, and I remember the physical feeling, you know, it was warm going down, didn't taste very good, and I thought, you know, what if people go in and be like, it's not such a big deal, you know, it didn't really do anything for me. But of course, my parents are sitting right there next to me, my little sister who's like not able to drink yet, and they're just staring like, what is it going to do, you know, and so I'm just like, it's fine, you know, like, I mean, there was no like anything attached to it, it was just, you know, physical. And I only had one, and my parents would only let me have one, so it was just kind of like, well, this is kind of dumb, you know, that's how I felt. And then the first time I felt the effect produced by alcohol, that is what sticks in my mind. And in Doctor's Opinion, it says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. So, yeah, I mean, I liked this. Once I started drinking it, it was because of that effect. And when I went to college, I was across the country. I didn't know anyone. I felt very, again, segregated. You know, I felt very different from everyone else because, in actuality, I did look very different from everybody else. I was coming from California, going to the Midwest. There was a very high population of people who looked very different from me in, you know, in the college. And everybody also seems to know how to drink. Because I went to a college with a very high drinking culture, and when I first got there, I had no idea how to be. You know, they threw us into a week of meeting people, which is like my worst nightmare. You know, being thrown into a bunch of strangers and having to, like, talk about who you are and, like, say where you're from and, you know, smile the whole time. You know, this was just not my idea of fun. And I did not feel that I had any choice in attending that. You know, it was what they did. And at the end of that week, that was orientation, my college, they had something called, it was an underground thing called disorientation. So the seniors in the dorm would take all the little girls out, you know, to the parties at Turtle Creek, you know, Turtle Creek apartment alley, and on Friday night, you know, and have disorientation. And that seemed a little bit better, you know, at least it was dark. People weren't really trying to talk to me, you know, they kind of were doing their thing. And I remember, like, a beer being thrust into my hand, and it was like, of course, totally unsafe. Like, what could be in this drink? I have no idea, you know? And it was just like, drink it, you know? And that was my first, I drank it, and I remember as soon as I drank that beer, first of all, it didn't taste good. I'd tasted beer before, but never, you know, the effect. But I drank the whole cup because, you know, I'm not, I mean, they're saying this is what's going to make it fun. So, you know, I finished the cup and I immediately started to relax. Immediately. And not just relax like, you know, I'm really wound up, but relax like, oh, this is what feeling normal feels like. This is what it's like to be in a room of people and feel part of. Everybody else had a cup in their hand, and so did I, you know, and everybody else was acting a little loopy and acting a little silly, and so was I, and I could be part of that. And remember, I told you in high school, I'll put on whatever mask you want me to put on, you know, so that drink, that was my ticket in, you know, and then I had one, and it was like, well, maybe another one will make this better, you know, so I had another, and it did make it better, you know, because I had even less inhibition, you know, in interacting with everybody at that party. And I don't, who knows? I don't even know what my interactions were like with people, you know, back then. I don't even know if I really even said what my name was. And, you know, they're fast forward going to parties in college. I'd be walking down the quad and see people that's like, that person sounds familiar. I don't know. And they would like smile at me and wave. And I'm like, hello, you know, don't know who you are, you know. And like, I look back at that now and think, gosh, that is horrible. You know, people were like meeting me and I wasn't meeting them, you know, and so it was very one-sided. But, so, you know, I really dove in hard, you know, to that lifestyle. There was actually, there was a running tally on my dorm room door, you know, how many nights has Marissa not been in the dorm, and it was like a contest, well, it was a contest for like all the girls, you know, on the floor, and I was like way ahead of everybody else, and that, I'm so proud of that statistic, you know, like, yeah, I don't even have a home, you know, and like, who knows where I was spending my time, you know, it was just, yeah, many, many poor decisions made, you know, and so poor, actually, that I got in trouble really fast for alcohol, and in my school, you know, there was a really big drinking culture, so alcohol, you would get in trouble for it, but it wasn't really a big deal. But what you did get a really big, what was really big deal was staying overnight in the dorm of the opposite sex. And I was caught attempting to do that, you know, walking up the stairs. And I was drunk, of course, and, you know, so was he. Everyone involved was drunk, except the RA who caught us, of course, you know, they were responsible. And I got in trouble. And it was probably like, I don't know, maybe the first 3 weeks of school or something like that. So the woman who ran the dorm, she said point blank to me, you're the first person to get in trouble from alcohol and you're a freshman. So I am definitely making an example of you. You know? And I did not feel very good. My parents got a letter sent home to them before I was able to tell them what happened. That letter went home. So, of course, their hard-earned money that's going to my college experience is being thrown down the drain, right? And I have to do community service or pay off my community service hours. It was 250 hours of community service or any combination thereof. And then I also had to do 12 hours of alcohol counseling. So at that time, the word AA wasn't thrown around anywhere. It was, you're going to show up at the Office of Drug and Alcohol Counseling on campus, and you're going to meet with this therapist named Kelly, and you're going to talk about your drinking, and that's it. You know, I don't know what was supposed to come of that. So we would meet, you know, and Kelly would ask things like, well, you know, do you think that maybe you could find a way to, like, track the drinks that you're having? And I would say, okay, sure, like, or some tactics, you know, and he would say, well, you're going to have a beer can, like, pop the tab and then put it in your pocket, and then when you get to, like, 7, you know, in the course of the night, then you know that you're done. And I was like, okay. So I went and I tried that at a party, and I went to, you know, the next week to go to counseling, and he was like, so how'd it go? And I was like, well, yeah, I got to 7, and then I got to 12 and 15 and 20. You know, like, I mean, I was counting, but, you know, I really didn't stop. I had no interest in stopping when I got to 7, you know, because by the time I got to 7, I thought, well, I'm doing pretty good. You know, let's continue. And then lost track, you know. So then he had a different approach. Like, okay, well, if you're not going to track it, maybe let's just talk about, like, the calories that go into this, you know? Like, you're an athlete, you know, you seem to be, like, somebody who cares about how you're fit and everything, and, like, so let's look at the caloric content of this, you know? And that just wasn't, I mean, who cares? I was like, yeah, but you know what it makes you feel like? You know, like, I don't care how many calories are in it, you know? Like, but maybe they should work on making low-calorie beer, and then they have, you know? And I did rely on that for a long time into my drinking. And so, we would meet. One more tactic he tried, you know, he tried to go from, like, the sheer volume of it. Like, if you would drink, like, 8 glasses of orange juice in one sitting, you might be sick, you know, like, in the course of an hour and a half lunch, you know. But in the course of a party of, like, an hour and a half, like, it sounds like it's really easy for you to have, like, 5 or 6 shots. And I was like, okay, again, Kelly, like, 8 glasses of orange juice does not make me feel the way that 5 shots makes me feel. No, it doesn't make me feel alive. It doesn't make me feel like I can talk to anyone I want to talk to and I can be somebody that I'm not. You know, it doesn't have that effect on me. So nothing he was trying was really working. And really, bless his heart, I hope he's well today. I've actually tried to, like, find out his information just so I can tell him I'm sober, and I cannot for the life of me find out. I don't remember his last name, so that was part of the issue. But he tried really hard. You know, he tried everything that human power and his training in psychology and pharmacology, you know, and even theology, because I didn't go to a Catholic university. He tried all of that, and it didn't work, you know, because I'm an alcoholic. I suffer from a spiritual malady. No level of intellect is going to help me get sober unless it goes from my head to my heart. And it was never getting to my heart. Eventually, we run one-on-one counseling, and he put me in groups. He's like, okay, you graduated from one-on-one, and we're going to go to groups. It was similar, I guess now looking back, similar to AA, but it was all on campus, so the students from around. And these are the stories I heard. I had a 0.4 drinking, you know, alcohol content, and I was still dancing in the party, and I was still standing. And I thought, okay, well, 0.4 is ridiculous. Like, I don't think my blood alcohol content ever gets that high. Like, I'm not with you, you know. I'll hear people say things like, oh, this is my second time around. At this university, I got kicked out for a semester because I was drinking too much, and now I'm here. That, I didn't identify with that either. I kept looking for the reasons that I was not like them. And really, if they had sent me to AA, I was not like you. You know, I was looking for all the ways that I was still better than. You know, I was still not as bad, or still in denial that I was either one of those extremes that I've been raised with. I was not super heavy go lucky, whatever, and I wasn't ruling with an iron fist. So really wasn't interested in any of that. So then me getting in trouble as a freshman worked to my advantage, because I finished my community service, I paid off the difference, I think I did like 200 hours, I paid off the difference, and then I started getting involved in the alcohol, drug, and alcohol, the Office of Alcohol and Drug Counseling, and I became a student advocate for people who got in trouble like me, so that I could be with them and say, hey, they shouldn't get in that much trouble. The reason I did that is because I didn't want people to be getting in trouble for alcohol at my university, because I didn't want to be getting in trouble for alcohol at my university. So I started to become part of the system, you know, so that I could break it from within. And that was always what I was chasing, you know, being different, using being different to my advantage, so that I could, you know, control and manipulate any situation that I was in. So that's how my drinking started. And it lasted for 10 years. I started drinking when I was 18. I got sober when I was 28. And in that time, so there was a series of progressive deterioration, right? The typical and incomprehensible demoralization. And those things happened with great intensity in a way that was still inconsequential to me. So the large consequences of alcohol were still rendered inconsequential because of how much the effect was producing what I saw as positives in my life. So when I started to get a little bit more into the darkness, one of them was I lived in New Orleans and I worked at a boys' home. And I went out on Bourbon Street one night and I lost the keys to the house, which was a big deal because that they'd have to re-key the house. You know, there's minors that live in the house, and so, you know, you can't just lose a key and there's no consequence. And yet I tried to make no consequence. I asked one of my coworkers, like, hey, can I borrow your keys? And I went and I made copies of those keys. But I made the mistake of telling my coworker what I was doing. And she, of course, because she had a moral code, told the boss, you know, and so I got called in. And it was my last night, like, working there. And she said, that was the absolute wrong thing for you to do. You know, there's children's lives are at stake. And you're putting their lives in danger because you don't want to get in trouble. And you need to, you know, the consequences of your actions, you need to feel them. Otherwise, you're going to keep making mistakes like this. So that was, like, strike one, you know, working with children, putting their lives in danger. Fast forward, I'm out of college, I'm in a graduate program, and I'm tutoring to put myself to this program and making money on the side, you know, when I'm not teaching or when I'm not studying. And it's pretty good for a while. You know, these people are inviting me into their homes. I go there on the weekends, you know, I meet with their children. And one night, I had an evening tutoring session. And I was invited to go out for drinks with one of my superiors at work, because I have, like, two jobs. And I was like, okay, I can go for, like, one drink, and then I can go to this tutoring session. So I went for one drink. I had not one drink. But I had, like, three. So I was feeling I wasn't, like, out of control, but I was definitely intoxicated. And I drove the, like, 2 miles to get to the tutoring job, and I was sitting in my car. I called my husband or my boyfriend at the time, who was already in the program, and I was like, I am not sober, but I can't not show up for this tutoring session. And he was like, what does that do if you don't do it? Do whatever you want, because it's not his business, you know, what I do with my disease. And I went into that session, and I held it together for like maybe 10 minutes. You know, I was like, okay, we're going to do this worksheet, here you go. And I was like, let's go to the bathroom. And so I went into the bathroom, I looked at myself, and I just said, how pathetic are you? You know, I said that to myself in the mirror. Like, this fourth grader, you know, is asking you, inviting you into his home, his mom, because they trust that you can help him do his work. Like, his mom is actually not educated enough to help him with his homework, and she's paying you to be in this house, and you're showing up drunk or whatever it is, you know? And that's why I was like, okay, so I like splashed water in her face, and I was like, okay, well, I can't think about that now. I've got to go back out there because I've been in here for 15 minutes, you know? Like, why are you in the bathroom 15 minutes, you know? So I go back out there, and I handle it, but I get into my car, and I just feel so horrible, you know? And not only do I feel horrible about showing up drunk to this tutoring session, strike two, you know, against a child, but also the fact that I drove, you know, intoxicated, which I've done many times. I've never done a DUI, but a well-deserved, if I'd ever gotten pulled over, it would have been well-deserved. And I put my life in danger, you know, and the lives of others on the road. So that was really not great. That was probably about, 8 years in. And then final bottom that brought me in. So while I was going through this, I was actually going to AA, but I was not identifying as an alcoholic because I mentioned the person I was dating was an alcoholic, so I went in as like an ally, you know, so I could sit and say, oh, I'm Marissa's friend, you know, or Marissa, I'm just listening today. And I would go, but I would go pretty religiously. Like, he has a pretty strong program, so maybe like once a week or so I'd go and still be drinking, you know, but hearing things and finding myself, because I can put a mask on, you know, nodding along, like, oh, okay, that's cool, or like active listening, like making eye contact and looking really genuinely interested, you know, what people were saying. But it wasn't, it was definitely planting seeds, but I wasn't ready to cultivate them yet, you know. So they were saying things to me, and some of the women would come up to me after and say, hey, you know, like, how you doing? And, you know, kind of like minorly false-setting me, you know, just kind of making it aware that I could call them at any time, you know, and things like that. And I remember this one woman one time, she was a little more direct, you know, and she came to me and she was like, hey, you've been coming to this meeting for like 6 months. And I was like, yeah, I'm here with my boyfriend, you know, like, and she was like, well, what do you get out of it? Like, why are you coming? And I remember having such a resentment against her, like, how do you question my desire to be here, you know? And that should have been a clue, you know, at the time that I was hearing stuff that I needed to hear. So I'm going to AA, I'm hearing the message, I'm seeing that the person I'm dating is really happy, you know, like, we'll get in fights, and she's, like, able to bounce back or just be like, okay, I'm walking away right now, you know, and I'm there like, you can't walk away from me, you know, like, holding on, like, get my heels into the ground, you know, and, you know, anyway, so that's how it's going, and we are meeting his family, you know, we're very clear that we're in love, that we're probably going to get married, and planning the family, and there's a young girl, you know, there's a niece, who is the love of his life, right? And he is the love of her life, and they're so connected. And I'm like, well, that's the girl that I got to impress, right? This little girl is the one who's going to be the key. You know, if I get her heart, we're good, you know? I'm the family. And she was pretty open to it, you know? She was like, seven, you know, she wanted an aunt, you know, she wanted somebody to be in her life. So she would invite me to do a bunch of stuff, you know? She was like, let's do this, let's hang out. We would go down to her parents' house, and of course I would drink with her husband and her mom, or her mom and dad, my sister-in-law's husband, and I would drink, but it was like all fun and games, no conviviality, and one night, we were drinking, she asked me to read her story and put her to bed. So I was in her bed reading the story. She said, I really want waffles tomorrow, and I said, okay, yeah, I'll wake up and I'll make you waffles, and I passed out in the bed that night, and luckily she also did, I guess. You know, she kind of like fell asleep because she's seven and whatever, and I passed out. I don't recall. I might have finished the story. I don't recall. I woke up in the morning, and she was kind of like moving, and then she goes, waffles! And I felt so horrible. I had drank so much, and I felt horrible, and I was just like, be relaxed. Thing I want to do is get out of this bed right now and make waffles for this 7-year-old girl. It's the last thing I want to do. And so, anyway, I get out of bed, I go down there, and I start making the batter, you know, I'm heating up the waffle, and I'm just like, you know, every time, I'm just like, oh God, you know, I don't know if I'm going to get through this, you know? And making the batter, I pour the first waffle, put the cover down, and my boyfriend walks down, and I'm like, okay, well, you're taking over because I can't handle this anymore. And I run upstairs, and I start, you know, yeah, relieving myself, you know, and I can hear them all downstairs laughing. You know, I can hear her being like, I love waffles, and like, where's the syrup? And everyone's down there, my brother-in-law, my sister-in-law, my boyfriend, and I am just missing out completely on this. You know, this thing that I wanted to give her, this memory of waffles, I couldn't even participate in it. So I'm in bed feeling horrible. My boyfriend's in. I'm like, sorry, I can't do this. You know, I'm just like so crap. And I hear this little like knock at the door, you know, and she says, Auntie Marissa, can you play the game of life with me? And I was like, okay, God, you know, and I said, I can't. I cannot play the game of life with you right now. And that is all I needed to say and hear about alcohol. You know, it stripped me of my ability to do life in the ways that I wanted to. You know, I wanted to be present for children, eventually my own children. Up until this point, I was letting everybody else's children down. And then I thought, how can I even have my own children if I can't even, you know, show up for these other people's children? So it took me, that was like July 4th weekend when that happened. And it took me like 2 weeks to get in here. I don't think I may have drank into that time, I don't really recall, but on the 16th of July, 2014, is when I woke up, and that morning I said, I think I need to stop drinking. And my boyfriend right there was like, well, the meeting at 3 o'clock today, that's what you know. And I was like, oh, you were waiting for that moment, you know. So I went to that meeting at the club down in Torrance, and it was a biker meeting. And, you know, I think if I'd walked into any other meeting to identify as an alcoholic, I don't know if I would have stayed. But what I needed to see were that there were people who I really could glorify. You know, the biker lifestyle, I really like it because it's like I already think they're courageous because they're like riding a bike in between cars, which I find very, like, I would never do it, you know. But also they're people who live very outwardly, like you can tell that they're bikers, you know. So and they identify with being that way, and they're confident and proud to live that way. And I was very attracted to that, you know. So going to that meeting and seeing all these people who were also sober, who had given up drinking, and who had found a way to live in that way, in a culture really that does sometimes call them to, like, you know, drink and do drugs, that was appealing to me. So I identified as an alcoholic in that meeting and have not looked back since. But I will say that for 7.5 years, identifying as an alcoholic, all it meant to me was I don't drink today. That's all it meant. So I was not interested in really changing who I was or who I am as a person. You know, I was like, well, all I need to do is stop drinking. And they say the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. And I had that, and I did stop drinking, so I don't have to do anything else. I got a sponsor to have a sponsor. We kind of did the steps in the beginning. You know, I don't know if you guys are familiar with this book, but she had me pick up this book called The Artist's Way, which was like creative output and the 12 steps, you know, and I thought, oh yeah, like I'm artistic, sure, I can do this, you know, and she was actually a professional ballerina for much of her career, and so that, you know, was what she, and then we were reading books like The 12 Steps and The 10 Commandments, you know, because I'm a cradle Catholic, and, you know, maybe that is like the brand of AA, you know, I needed, and never once, like, she wasn't like, well, you should buy this book, never, you know, and that's not on her, you know, I never asked, should I maybe have a big book? You know, that wasn't something that was on my radar. I was just so happy to have a sponsor who didn't tell me what to do. Everything was a very soft suggestion. Like, maybe we should get together this week and read some of this book. Okay. You know, or I'm not really available. Okay. You know, it was just not something that was the center of my life whatsoever. But I was living with somebody who was in the program. Alcohol was not part of our home. So it was, in essence, fairly acceptable for me not to drink, and nobody was pushing that lifestyle on, pushing like the party or drinking lifestyle on me. So my significant other being sober and not wanting to let him down, that was good enough for a long time. You know, it was a pretty decent row, and I know some of the rooms here like to say, you know, your life, if you just take away alcohol, your life gets better because you have suddenly more time, you know, you're not spending as much money on booze, so things will change, you know, but myself, I was not changing, and I was plugging into a bunch of other sources, you know, I was becoming a workaholic, in my sobriety in those first 7 years, I had 3 kids, you know, and it was like, oh, I'm pregnant, you know, so I could lean into that really hard, you know, be part of that. I got really into, like, being religious and, you know, being involved in my church, but not ever being involved in AA. You know, I didn't want people to know my name, really. I would go to meetings very sporadically so that I didn't have to be known, and I would go so sporadically that people would introduce themselves to me and think I was a newcomer. They'd be like, oh, is this your first time? And I'd be like, no, it's 3.5 years, you know? They'd be so angry and resentful. Like, do I look like a newcomer, you know? But I acted like one, you know? I was definitely acting like a newcomer, you know? I had no interest in being part of. In that time, when I was about 5 years sober, COVID hit. And I'm an educator, so Zoom meetings were not a no. They were a no for me. Because I had spent all day on Zoom with kids, you know, and being really present and having to put on shows. You know, no, I'm not into that. So I didn't go to a meeting for the entire time that COVID in-person meetings were not allowed. And I was dying, You know, I didn't know. I felt like I had no solution. You know, like, yeah, I'm living with an alcoholic. We can talk about program all day long, but I'm not really doing any of the work. I'm not connecting with other people in the program. Nobody has my number. Literally not once did I get someone to text me to say, oh, here's a Zoom link. Okay, so even if I wanted to go to a Zoom meeting, nobody was reaching out to me. And that's not on anybody else. That's on me. Nobody had my number to reach out. You know, I didn't want to be reached out to, and that was the life in AA that I cultivated. You know, I wanted to be left alone. I didn't want to be part of. So I, once the restrictions were lifted and I could go back to a meeting in person, I remember there were still masks down in Ventura where we were living. You saw them wear a mask outside, and I wanted to go to a meeting, and I told my husband, I really want to go to, I really think I need to go to a meeting today. And that was the first time, like, I had ever said that, you know, like, I need to go to a meeting. And he said, I don't want to wear a mask at a meeting, let's not go, you know, and I just was like, what, you know, and instead of going myself, I just seethed in the room, like, he didn't want me to get sober, he didn't want me to stay, like, I might as well drink, like, getting angry at him for inhibiting my program when I'm very capable of getting the car and driving over there and going to a meeting, you know, like, I am not a invalid, I could do that, you know, and yet, I loved having, being the victim. I love being in self-pity. I love thinking that everybody's out to get me and everybody's working against me. I love that, and I got so much strength from that. Yeah. And then we moved here to Orchid, and meetings were in person. You couldn't wear, you didn't have to wear a mask. And so he had no excuse, I had no excuse. We were trying to do 90-90 because we know we're trying to put roots down in a new community. And I remember going to my first meeting at the Lion's Den. And the Lion's Den is, I consider that to be my in-person home group here in town. I do have a home group that is international and funny enough online and Zoom. I mean, every week with them on Zoom. But that is my home group here because I remember walking into that room and for the first time, I didn't have to do anything. I felt like crud, you know? I felt like AA, I don't even know what this is about. I felt so like nervous and in that room, it was all love, welcoming, you know, people saying hello, you know, oh, hi. And it didn't matter if it was that they just moved here or from Renewed. They didn't care. They didn't know. They weren't trying to figure that out. They just stuck up their hand and said, you know, welcome. And it was like a bright room, you know, and I just remember feeling like, oh, is this what it's supposed to feel like when you walk into AA? Because I have never had that experience before. You know, I've been afraid going into AA. I felt judged going into AA. I felt all these things, but I never felt truly welcome. So that was great. And as we were doing more meetings, it was suggested to me to get a commitment. Actually, no, it wasn't. I heard that a commitment was needed. And so I went up to the GSR commitment at Lion's Den, and they had been announcing it forever. And Jesse was like, okay, guys, like, we still don't have a DSR for this meeting. And I heard that a couple times, and I went up to him like 3 or 4 weeks in. And I was so nervous to ask because in my sobriety, when I was like 5 years sober or so, there was that same announcement was being made in a meeting in Ventura. And I went up to the person. I said, oh, I would like to serve in this capacity. And he was like, well, you don't really come to this meeting very often. And like, it has to be somebody who really comes to this meeting, so I don't think you can do that. And I was so resentful, like, I want to serve, and you're not letting me. So then, I never tried to serve again, you know? So when I went up to Jesse, I was like, I was so prepared to be aggressive again. I was so prepared to be told no. And he was like, really? Like, really? And I was like, I guess. He was like, great, you know? So he signed me up. And I had no idea what I was getting into with that. Because general service is wild, you know. I actually highly recommend general service for anyone who just wants to really practice the principles. To be in a room where a lot of people are practicing their principles, you know, that it really is a great way to humility. So I started getting into service commitments, and I was doing that. I, you know, picked up some other things, going to meetings regularly, and I've been still feeling very empty, still feeling like, okay, I'm doing all the things that people in AA say to do, you know, I have a sponsor, because I still had her, right, in name, she lived in Ventura, I didn't live where I was, never called her, and yet I did have a sponsor, you know, I worked the steps, kind of, you know, I had made amends to random people over the course of, you know, 7 years and whatever, you know, and people would ask me to sponsor them, and I'd be like, you don't want me to sponsor you, you know, so. And so, you know, kind of doing things, but feeling like I don't understand what's going on. And then I met my sponsor, and I met her at a speaker meeting. And she got up in front of the podium, and she was sharing things about herself that I thought about myself that I would never admit in a public setting, ever, you know. And she admitted them with laughter, with joy, with calm serenity, you know, and like, of course, this is me, and it's fine, you know. And I just thought, oh, God, you know, that's not ever what I want to do. And yet, as she was talking, I was leaning in more. I was standing up straighter, and it was like a fire hose of information coming at me. And I was hearing all the stuff that I needed to hear, and I wanted more. Like, I wanted her to talk for 20 more hours. Like, I could sit there, like, tell me more, tell me more. And at the end, and I, you know, I was like, I want what she has. And what I heard in her story was this. She said, when I asked my sponsor to be my sponsor, he asked me, are you willing to take direction, no matter what, as long as it's not illegal or immoral? And I heard him out of my mouth, yes. And I thought to myself, I have never once said yes to that question because I am terrified of authority. I am terrified to hand over to somebody else the reins to my life because that's how my dad rules our house, and I am not interested, you know. And yet, when she said that, I thought, that is the only thing in this program I have not done yet. I have not actually given somebody the authority in my life to guide me to a spiritual end. I have not done that, so I want to. And she has the courage to say yes. I want that courage, too. So I went up to her and I said, will you be my sponsor? And she said, well, call me tomorrow at 4. And I was like, okay, that's very specific. I was like, okay, I will do that. She said, we'll talk. I'll be at the airport. So I called her the next day at 4:15. And she was like, well, I told you to call me at 4. You know, I was like, oh, I was at a baby shower and I couldn't. And she was like, it doesn't matter. It's just if I ask you to do something, you need to do it the way that I ask you. I was like, okay. And that was it. I was like, whoa, this is totally different. And any other time before that 7.5 years when I was so desperate to feel different because I felt so, what's the point? I was afraid I was going to drink because I just felt like I'm doing everything that people say and yet I feel empty inside. I feel as empty as I felt when I stopped drinking or when I was drinking, you know, my bottom. I felt like I can't do this life. I'm yelling at my kids all the time. I don't know what to do. And so I'm desperate to do anything. So the next day I called her. I told her like a story. And she said, well, do you know what that is? It was like a story about I got in a fight or something. And I said, well, yeah, I mean, it's ego. Like, spitting back at her, whatever I hear at AA, like, oh, everything's ego, pride, you know. I was like, yes, ego. And she's like, well, I mean, it's ego, but it's gross immaturity. You're really immature. And I was like, what? You know, I'm a principal of a school. Like, I'm not immature. But when she said that, I thought, wow, for the first time somebody really sees me, because I am really immature. I'm a baby. I got sober when I was 28, and I have never grown up, and she sees that in me, and I bet you she knows how to get me to grow up. And from that point forward, I have taken direction from her, you know, like nobody's business. And, you know, she's a great sponsor because she didn't lay it on all at one time. Today, the work that I do is, you know, calling 5 people a day that are in my sponsorship family. I call her 3 times a week. I do 10 steps like crazy, and I have to do this morning thing and an evening thing, and it's all this stuff. And if she had said all of that to me at the beginning, I would have said, oh, no, thank you. I'm not into this, you know. But she did it really softly. She was like, first, just call. Here's a list. Call some people. She didn't say 5. She just said call some people. So I called one person, and I said, I don't know what to do on this call. And she said, well, Marissa, I ask people how their day is going, and then I listen. And I was like, oh, that's so simple. That's all you have to do. But that's not something I ever did. You know, I never called people in AA. I didn't know. I don't even talk to my friends that often. You know, I'm so selfish and self-centered. I have no interest in what's going on in other people's lives. And yet, you know, I was calling people. And now I can say happily that today I do call people. You know, I call 5 people a day for my sponsorship family, and I'm genuinely interested. And sometimes I call 7 or 8, you know, because I want to know what's going on in their lives. And that's a miracle. That in and of itself is a miracle in this program, because somebody that didn't even want to be known by anybody, I didn't want my number to be known by anyone. Now all these people have my number, and it's on a phone list, you know, that people can call. And, you know, I speak at our meetings, you know, I'm asked to share on a topic, and I'm able to share experience, strength, and hope with others in a way that I never really thought possible. It is Dr. Penny that says here, on the other hand, as strange as it may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. And today, those rules for me are simple. All I have to do is call 5 people a day, and I have to share what's going on in my day. I have to pray a little bit in the morning and a little bit in the evening, and from that, it is easy, right? I will be easily able to control my desire for drinking. Yes, you know, I'll do it. Sign me up right now today. But it took me that long to realize that that's what I needed to do the actual footwork. I thought just being around here, putting on a mask and being part of this group would be enough to keep me sober, to really lead me to being happy, joyous, and free. But it wasn't. It was doing the work. And the inventories that I do, you know what? They get me to see some really, really negative things about myself. You know, I did an inventory just this week where I admitted to myself that I love finding other people's faults, and I get great comfort in seeing how much better I am than they are, and especially my bosses, especially people that have authority over me, you know, and I got to see that and say, hey, that's not being one of God's kids. You know, all we're asked to do is to carry out God's will for us. It's not God's will for me to find out how much better I am than one of his other creations. You know, it's my job to be more equal to my brothers and sisters, more equal to the people here in the room. You know, not finding differences, but becoming more and more equal. To be a man, a woman among, you know, to be a man among men, you know, to be one of my fellows. And it is an absolute pleasure that I get to serve those in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I'm able to give back to this program that has given me infinite gifts, remarkable gifts, things that I could never have orchestrated myself. And if you're new here today, you know, Chris and Jose, I hope that you stick around enough to find out those things that God has orchestrated for you, because they're phenomenal. And I will leave it there. Thank you.
Let's give Marissa another round of applause.